from scratch, but none of us can do that. While he would not acknowledge that the department had made mistakes in the investigation of the case, he did assert that with contemporary technology and the professional team I have today, it's possible things could have turned out much differently. Stone refused to address specific blunders Walsh pointed out in the investigation of the crime, choosing instead to focus on the fact that nothing could have saved Adam's life. "The FBI didn't kill Mr. Walsh's son," Stone said. "The media didn't kill Mr. Walsh's son. And the Hollywood Police Department didn't kill Mr. Walsh's son." While true, it might have sounded a bit callous of the new chief, who was quoted in closing, "I've spoken with the few people who are still here who worked the case, and they feel they bent over backward to help the Walshes and investigate this case." Undeniably, bending over backwards and doing one's best are admirable traits, but when it comes to assessing the quality of the investigation of a murder case, questions of capability are more germane. In any case, Stone would not last much longer at the top in Hollywood. He may have gotten along well with his own superiors, but before another year had passed, he had begun to clash with the police union, and in late 1998, he was dismissed. At that point, Finns approached Broward Sheriff Ken Jenny for interim help, and Jenny assigned Major Al Lamberti as temporary chief while commissioners launched another search. Finally, in July 1999, they were successful in luring James Scarberry, assistant chief for the city of Miami Beach, to the position. Scarberry, a 27-year veteran with a reputation as a cop's cop, was endorsed by the police union and was capable as an administrator as well. Nor was Scarberry confronted in any meaningful way regarding the Adam Walsh case, though reminders of its enduring power continued to surface. The March 14, 2001 death of Henry Lee Lucas, serving a life term in a Texas prison, prompted a call to Hollywood PD for a comment on Lucas's one-time role as a suspect in the case. But Detective Sergeant Mark Smith, by then in charge of the department's homicide unit, reminded reporters that Lucas had been in a Maryland jail at the time of Adam's disappearance. When questioned about the status of that investigation, Smith said simply, "It's still an open case." In July 2001, the Miami Herald ran a pair of lengthy articles by staff writer Daniel DeVise concerning the case, concurrent with the 20th anniversary of Adam's disappearance. The first focused on the impact of the case on the nation's attitudes, rewriting laws and redefining relationships between adults and children. "Many tragic child murders had faded from the public consciousness," DeVise wrote, "but Adam Walsh's endures." That was likely due to the indefatigable John Walsh, DeVise opined, who included in his piece criticism directed at Walsh by some experts. "In some ways, he's taken his personal tragedy and inflicted it upon the nation," a Mount Holyoke College sociologist was quoted as saying. "He's made all kids afraid." Noted pediatrician Benjamin Spock had also criticized the practice of placing the pictures of missing children on milk cartons, said to have begun at Chicago-area Hawthorne Melody Farms and copied by legions of others across the country, including South Florida's MacArthur Dairy. While Spock understood the impetus behind such efforts, he worried that it turned breakfast into a ritual of terror for the young and impressionable. But others, particularly the parents of children lost and missing, praised Walsh's work in redefining a nation's indifference to a significant problem. As a spokesperson for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children put it, "Before the Adam Walsh case, it was easier to locate a stolen car than a missing child." That first piece ended with a reprise of milestones to date in what DeVise referred to as the Missing Children Movement, including the FBI database established by the Missing Children Act of 1982 and the 1984 legislation establishing the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Also referenced was Megan's Law of 1996, named after Megan Kanka, a New Jersey 7-year-old raped and murdered by a child molester who had moved into the neighborhood unbeknownst to residents. That measure required the notification of communities when a freed sex offender moves into a neighborhood. DeVise also cited the Amber Alert System, named for Amber Hagerman, a 9-year-old resident of Arlington, Texas, kidnapped while riding a bicycle near her home, her body later discarded in a ditch. It began as a grassroots movement in 1996 and has since been formalized nationwide, with bulletins interrupting radio programming and emblazoned on highway alert displays and elsewhere during the first hours following an abduction. Also mentioned was the Jimmy Rice Act, the Florida measures named after a young homestead boy taken and killed by a handyman, allowing law enforcement to publicize the identities of sexual offenders and extend the sentences of the most violent sexual predators. On July 27, 2001, Devise's follow-up piece centered on the status of the long-stalled investigation. Devise cataloged the emergence and dismissal of various individuals considered as suspects, including the quickly cleared John and Reveille Walsh and Jimmy Campbell, who, Devise pointed out, not only passed his polygraph examinations but also had an alibi. Devise also rehashed the brief flurry caused in November 1981 when a drifter in a Broward County lockup claimed his cellmate Edward James had confessed to the crime. As it turned out, however, James, who passed a voice stress analysis test, was proven to be at work the day of the crime. And in 1995, there were reports in an Alabama newspaper contending that Michael Monahan, the younger son of Walsh's former boss John Monahan, might have murdered Adam Walsh as a favor to his pal Jimmy Campbell. After all, police records showed that just 3 days after Adam's disappearance, the younger Monahan had slashed through a door of a Broward County home with a machete during a dispute over a stolen skateboard. But that also came to nothing. Tests on the machete revealed no evidence, and Monahan had an alibi for his whereabouts at the time of Adam's death. Once he passed a polygraph exam, police quickly cleared him as well. Otis Toole remained the most likely suspect, Devise wrote, before adding the familiar saw, but there is no hard evidence to support it. For his story, Devise tracked down former Hollywood Police Chief Richard Witt, who acknowledged in an interview that the department could have done a better job. Focusing on Jimmy Campbell had probably been a mistake, and given their relative inexperience in such matters, they might have tried harder to get the FBI involved at the outset. Within the first few months of this case, Witt told Devise, it was really screwed up to the point where obtaining a conviction had been compromised. A companion piece in the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Fort Lauderdale was replaced in the paper's title in 2000, quoted Hollywood detective Mark Smith as admitting that the case was probably too big for us at the time, and while he stopped short of criticizing those who had preceded him, he did say, "The investigation was not handled to my satisfaction. Let's just leave it at that." While Smith stoutly proclaimed that he really believed that his department would close the case someday, he admitted that he had not interviewed anyone concerning the matter in more than 3 years. Attempts to solicit comment from former Detective Jack Hoffman, still on the force but scheduled for imminent retirement, went unanswered. In the end, and following a rehash of missed opportunities and dead-end investigations, Herald reporter Devise concluded, "The prospect that it will ever be solved has never looked so dim." So it had always been at Hollywood PD, it seemed, and so it would remain for most of Chief Scarberry's tenure as well. Despite Detective Smith's upbeat contentions, 5 more years would pass without further pronouncements on the case, until the Miami Herald published yet another milestone story, this one proclaiming the 25th anniversary of failure. Though this time there was a positive coda to add. 25 years after crime, a new federal law. The piece, mirrored by many in South Florida and around the nation, recounted the grim outline of Adam Walsh's kidnapping and murder, calling it a crime that would change the nation. Few parents would ever again leave their children alone or unattended in public places, reporters noted, pointing to such widespread practices as the Code Adam alerts broadcast by big-box retailers such as Walmart and Home Depot any time a child is reported lost in their stores. In addition, laws had changed to help police mobilize and defend on behalf of children, including the new Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, legislation that President Bush was poised to sign on the 25th anniversary of the tragic event. The act mandated 10-year prison sentences for sex crimes against persons under the age of 18, created a uniform sex offender registry in every state, and outlawed any depiction of sexual abuse of children and its dissemination. As to the case itself, however, commentators held out little hope for a solution. "The Walshes and all families of missing children never get closure," said Bill Fleischer, a Philadelphia forensic scientist and commissioner of the VDOC Society, a cold case investigative group. Despite the likelihood that their son's murderer would never be found, Fleischer called attention to the good that had come out of personal tragedy. "They are likely the most important advocates that the country has ever had for preventing and solving crimes against children." Still, there was always reason to hope, some opined. Detective Mark Smith again told reporters of his hopes that someone might come forward one day with information that would allow him to close the case, a prospect echoed by noted criminologist Vernon J. Geberth. "A new witness could come forward," said Geberth, former commander of the NYPD Bronx Homicide Unit. "A relative of the killer who knows about the crime may want to finally unburden himself." The Walshes had survived on such hopes for a quarter of a century, of course, and while John had assumed a role as a celebrity crime fighter in his own right, the years in the spotlight had not always been kind. In 1983, just a few weeks shy of the statute of limitations in such matters, the couple had contemplated suing Sears over what they considered shortcomings in store security, including the fact that 6-year-old Adam had simply been turned out on the street without so much as a "where are your parents, little boy?" However, attorneys for the company countered by saying that if the Walshes sued, they would parade details of Reveille's affair with Jimmy Campbell in court and paint her as an unfit mother. "It wasn't really a threat," a Sears attorney told reporters. "He was just trying to save the Walshes some embarrassment." Faced with such a prospect, the Walshes dropped the suit. And in 1999, as if following the statistical mandate that more than half of the couples who lose a child to tragedy will split up, some studies have put the figure as high as 80%, Reveille filed for divorce from John. However, there were 3 children still at home at the time, Megan, then 17, Callahan, 15, and Hayden, 14, and 4 months later, Reveille rescinded her petition. Eventually, the couple smoothed over their difficulties and resumed a united place at the forefront of efforts on behalf of missing and exploited children. As for Joe Matthews, his days following his retirement from Miami Beach PD remained full as well. He joined the faculty of the Center for Psychological Studies at Nova Southeastern University in the 1980s, and he continued on there, lecturing on investigative interviewing and clinical polygraph. He also traveled extensively about the United States, speaking at universities, police departments, and corporations on behalf of DNA Life Print, a company formed to offer child safety programs and distribution of an inexpensive home DNA identification kit, developed as a result of the difficulty he encountered in identifying baby lollipops. And while he had stepped away from his interest in polygraph services and instruction, he continued as an investigative consultant to law enforcement agencies and the private sector across the United States and in Canada. In 1999, when John Walsh asked if he might be interested in doing some investigative work for a new cold case component for America's Most Wanted, Matthews, a detective through and through, jumped at the opportunity. The producers expected that Matthews might present evidence pertaining to various cold cases and let the audience theorize for themselves what might have actually happened. But Matthews took one look at the known elements of the first case suggested to him, one involving the year-old death of a former high school wrestling champion in eastern Pennsylvania, and decided he could do better than what was proposed. After nearly 2 years of digging, he unearthed evidence proving the involvement of 4 drug-dealing University of Lock Haven football players in the killing. Having solved the first cold case investigation in the show's history, Matthews secured his career as an on-screen investigator. From time to time during their association, both Matthews and Walsh would reflect on the one case that had baffled authorities and galled them both, and they each vowed on more than one occasion that one day they would see justice served. In fact, from the time of the airing of the first AMW show on Adam in 1996, Matthews had followed up every tip concerning the case submitted to the program, calls that came on the average of 2 or 3 a month. The former homicide detective traveled around Florida and as far away as the prisons of Colorado and California in search of viable leads, but nothing panned out. And Matthews admits that if it hadn't been for the boorish reporter who buttonholed John Walsh in January 2006, just a few months before the signing of the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, things might have stayed that way forever. When Joe Matthews got the call from John Walsh to let him know he was coming to South Florida for an AMW shoot in early February 2006 and would like to get together, the detective didn't think too much about it. Matthews was still working regularly as an investigator for the show, and simply assumed that Walsh wanted to run an idea for some new investigation past him. Even when Walsh added that Revay would be with him and that they wanted to talk to him about an important matter, it still didn't register. Most of the time, John traveled by himself for the shoots, but since this one was in South Florida, it made sense that Revay would come along, and Matthews, who enjoyed her company, was happy to hear it. Walsh suggested that they meet at the Atlantic Hotel on Ocean Drive in Fort Lauderdale, where the crew would be set up, and Matthews said he'd be there with bells on. When he walked into the hotel's second-floor conference room on the afternoon of February 20th, Matthews found John and Revay waiting, along with Lance Heflin, then executive producer for AMW, and Heflin's wife, Jan. John invited Matthews to sit and began to explain why they'd asked him there that afternoon. It was only when Revay put her hand on John's arm and cut in that Matthews began to understand that something out of the ordinary was afoot. In all his years around the Walshes, he'd found that John usually did most of the talking while Revay listened patiently. She would have her incisive piece to add, to be sure, but it was almost always after John had led the way. As she began to speak on this day, Matthews was still trying to remember the last time he'd seen her interrupt her husband. "Excuse me, John," Revay said, then cast an apologetic glance at Heflin's wife. "But I'd like this to be a closed meeting. I'm sorry, Jan. It's just that it's a very sensitive matter." By the time that Heflin's wife had left the room, every cop instinct in Matthews was on alert. Again, John Walsh started his preamble. They'd been up in Washington a few days ago working the Hill on behalf of the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act when he'd been confronted with the question that had plagued him most of his adult life. As always, Walsh said, he realized the futility of trying to explain the million and one screw-ups involved. Then Revay interrupted again. "Joe," she said, "we've heard the question 100 times, and we'll hear it again on July 27th when we're back in Washington to watch the president sign the bill. Why can't you find out who killed your son? And you know what? I'm sick of it. Do you think I don't want to find out?" There were tears in her eyes by that point, and Matthews stole a glance at John and Heflin, two guys accustomed to riding in the front seat. But they were way, way in the back right now, he thought. "For 25 years, my husband has been pretty much in charge of this matter, protecting me from things. He's shielded me from the awful details, and he's minimized all the incompetence we've had to deal with from the police. He's done it because he loves me, and he doesn't want me to have to hear horrible things about what happened to our baby, particularly when he worries that they can't be proven. And he hasn't wanted to make me any more angry than I am already when the cops throw up their hands over and over again. But I'm here to tell you that all that has come to an end." She glanced at her husband, then turned back to Matthews. "When I left Adam that day, I told him, 'Honey, I'll be right over there in the lamp department.' And he looked back at me and said, 'I know where you'll be, Mommy.' Those are the last words I ever heard him say. That's the moment I've lived with for 25 years. And that is worse than anything some sick son of a bitch could ever say to me." Revay leaned across the table toward Matthews, who was riveted in his chair. By this point, the tears were streaming down her face. "I've known you a long time, Joe, and I think you're one of the few cops ever involved in Adam's case who knows what the hell he's doing." Matthews might have mumbled his thanks at that, but Reveille held up her hand to stop him. "But it's been 25 years," she said, her voice rising, "and nothing has happened. I still don't know who killed my little boy. I want you to investigate. I want to know every detail. I want to know who did what and who didn't do what." She was wiping away tears with the heels of both hands now. "This has nothing to do with the show. For John and me, for our sake as parents, I want you to prove once and for all who killed our son. We think we know who did it, but we want you to prove it. And we want the cops to clear this case. Until that happens, we won't have peace. It doesn't matter that Otis Toole is dead. He died without ever being charged, and as far as John and I are concerned, that's the same thing as going free. Our baby was murdered, and someone has to be held accountable. That's not too hard to understand, is it?" She paused, still wiping at her tears, and fixed Matthews with an even gaze. "Joe, will you do this for me?" At this point, everyone in the room was choked up. John Walsh leaned to comfort his sobbing wife, and Matthews struggled to get his voice under control. He'd spent his whole life trying to bring criminals to justice, and he knew exactly how Reveille felt. Her words spoke to the core of his reason for being. "I'm honored that you'd even ask," he told Reveille quietly. He would start immediately. He would investigate as he would were he a police officer assigned to a cold case, and he would bring to the job all that he had in him. He couldn't predict the outcome, of course. No one could. But at least this time there'd be no one there to throw him off the case. Hollywood, Florida, February 21st, 2006. The resurrection of the Adam Walsh case had never been a matter high on Hollywood Police Chief James Scarberry's priority list. Still, Scarberry knew that Matthews had put in a good word on his behalf with the Hollywood Police Union while he was being considered for the job, and he was also well aware of the blemish the high-profile matter had left on the record of his new department. Furthermore, Scarberry knew from his time in Miami Beach that Matthews was an accomplished cop. Whatever the public thought, you didn't get to be Officer of the Year by accident. Thus, when Matthews showed up in his office on February 21st, 2006, some 5.5 years after he'd taken over the reins in Hollywood, Scarberry knew enough to listen. He was there for important reasons, Matthews told Scarberry, and then got quickly to the point. Almost 25 years had passed since Adam Walsh went missing, and were he still alive, he would have been looking forward to celebrating his 32nd birthday. Nearly 10 years had passed since the record of the failed investigation in his abduction and murder had been made public, effectively putting an end to its investigation. And nearly 10 years had passed since the only viable suspect ever identified had died while imprisoned for other killings. There had been any number of lurid stories concerning the disappearances and deaths of children splashed across the pages of the newspapers of the nation and the region, those of Jimmy Rice and Shannon Melendi, a young South Florida woman kidnapped and slain by a softball umpire, among them. There might even be a few people who'd forgotten all about Adam Walsh, just one more unfortunate kid in what had become a long line of them. But Adam Walsh was really the first kid in that line, Matthews pointed out. Before Adam, there really wasn't much attention paid to the problem of missing and endangered children. And now, due in large part to the efforts of Adam's parents, John and Reveille Walsh, the issue had become one of the most important priorities of law enforcement and society as a whole. Yet for all that John and Reveille had accomplished, they had certainly not forgotten about Adam. Furthermore, as every new day dawned, they thought about the son whom they had so tragically lost, and they were reminded that his killer had yet to be brought to justice. Matthews recounted the recent incident in Washington, where John Walsh was confronted by a reporter who wanted to know if it ever bothered him that he had been unable to find the killer of his own son. If that reporter had any idea what John Walsh had gone through, Matthews reminded Chief Scarberry, he would have been running for the doorway before he finished his question. It was true that Walsh had heard such things before, And though he had placed his trust in the Hollywood PD for many years, he felt a certain amount of guilt that he hadn't done more to move the investigation forward earlier. He'd even felt bad that the baseless innuendo regarding his lifestyle and his ties to organized crime might have somehow affected the conduct of the case. And certainly there was a point to the reporter's question, offensive as it was. John Walsh had helped to apprehend a lot of bad guys in his time, but the worst one of all had gone scot-free. "That's why I'm here today," Matthews told Scarberry. He'd been asked by John and Reve Walsh to reopen the case and to conduct a complete, independent investigation to prove once and for all who had kidnapped and murdered their son. And Matthews, who was doing this as a favor to people he cared about and for the sake of justice, was asking for Scarberry's help. The files had been opened to every reporter under the sun 10 years ago, Matthews pointed out, though the motivations of those who wanted them opened were somewhat dubious, and their abilities to evaluate what they were looking at just as questionable. Matthews was an experienced investigator with a single aim in mind, to re-examine files and statements, re-evaluate evidence, and re-interview witnesses, and where new leads presented themselves, to follow them wherever they might go. As Scarberry well knew, Matthews had solved any number of cases thought to be unsolvable before. Surely, said Matthews, who had not come to take no for an answer, it was time to give him his final shot. John and Reve and Adam Walsh deserved that much, at least. Scarberry heard Matthews out, then sat back in his chair, considering things. He glanced away for a moment, then turned back to Matthews and gave his okay. If Matthews thought he could manage to prove anything after all these years, who was Scarberry or his department to stand in the way? He would have access to everything in the department's files, Scarberry told him, and he further assured Matthews that now Captain Mark Smith, the detective who had opened the cold case investigation with Matthews back in 1995, would provide whatever help he could. Godspeed and good luck. The promise of help from Mark Smith was a favor that Matthews could have just as well done without, he thought, but at least this time there was no selective withholding of files. The transfer of all case file documentation, including myriad reports, statements, memos, photos, and interviews, including those filmed and on CD, began the following day, February 22, 2006. Day after day, Matthews, convinced by their disarray that he was the first to do so, combed through the voluminous files, refreshing himself on details, cataloging crucial information and evidence, building, for the first time, a comprehensive chronology of events and identifying key witnesses who had never been interviewed or who were never asked the necessary questions in the first place. On Thursday, February 23rd, Matthews, backed by a film crew AMW's Lance Heflin had been happy to provide for the purposes of documentation, interviewed retired Hollywood detective Larry Hoisington regarding the things Otis Toole had told him on October 21, 1981, when Hoisington had been the driver for the team taking Toole around to the various scenes connected to the crime. Hoisington told Matthews that on that day, while Hoffman and others were busy with other things, Toole had given him a complete and independent confession to the crime, the gruesome details of which he recounted for Matthews. Hoisington also recounted Hoffman's treatment of Toole and repeated what he'd told Leroy Hessler the year before. I'm surprised Toole cooperated at all. Hoisington reiterated his conversation with Deputy Chief Hessler at the time and recounted Hessler's response that Hoisington simply tell Hoffman about it. Matthews pointed to the files, shaking his head. Despite Hoffman's assurances that he would include what Hoisington told him in his report, no such mention of Toole's confession to Hoisington existed there. On Saturday, February 25th, Matthews interviewed Arlene Meyer, who had identified Otis Toole as the man who accosted her and her daughter Heidi at a Hollywood Kmart store 2 days prior to Adam's abduction. They both recalled the incident vividly and confirmed that they had identified Toole from a lineup of photographs shown them by Hollywood police. For all the good it did, Matthews thought. Had Hoffman bothered to confirm Toole's encounter with the Myers when he had the chance, all this could have very likely been concluded back in 1983. The likely reason why Hollywood police had placed so little credence in what the Myers had told them had to do with the timing, Matthews understood. Arlene had been sure that their trip to Kmart took place on a Friday or a Saturday night, because those were the only nights they ever went shopping. But the fact that her husband wouldn't go into the store with them because he had just gotten off work suggested to detectives that it had very likely been a Friday night when the Myers had their frightening encounter. That, of course, would have ruled Toole out of the scenario, since he would have been on a bus somewhere between Newport News and Jacksonville at the time. However, Matthews had since spoken with Susan Schindehet, co-author of John Walsh's Tears of Rage. She'd wondered about that seeming inconsistency, too, she told Matthews, until she asked Wayne Meyer a simple question, one that the detectives never had. Did he ever work at his construction job on Saturdays? Oh, sure, Wayne told her, all the time. The simple questions, Matthews thought to himself as he finished up his notes on the Myers. When you forget to ask them during an investigation, that's when things go south. On the following Tuesday, February 28th, Matthews got in touch with prison hospital administrator Barry Gemelli, who confirmed that he had overheard the unsolicited confession to the crime by Otis Toole as he was lying on his deathbed. The two made arrangements to meet the following week. In the meantime, Matthews conducted an interview with Kathy Schaffer, the Sears security guard who had ordered Adam Walsh out of the store that day. His mom showed me two pictures of Adam that day, Schaffer told Matthews, and I wasn't really sure about the first one, but then she made me look at another one, and I knew right then. I was chilled. 110% I knew it was him. But she had lied to Revay that day and said she didn't recognize Adam because she was just 17 and she was scared. She thought Revay would get mad at her for throwing Adam out of the store, Schaffer said, and besides, at first she thought he was just some kid wandering around and he was going to turn up just fine without any help from her. By the time detectives arrived and were beginning to question her, she realized the enormity of what had happened. This child had really, truly disappeared. She couldn't own up to what she had done by then, she said to Matthews. She had started to feel truly responsible for Adam's disappearance. Eventually, she came to feel responsible for his death. I still do, she told Matthews tearfully. Not a day has gone by in 25 years that I haven't thought about it. If I had just said, "Where's your mama?" he might still be here today. She had to pause to gather herself before she could get her last words out, and even then Matthews had to ask her to repeat them. I pray every night that his mom and dad will forgive me. Matthews tried to console Schaffer, but he felt like the little Dutch boy his mother used to tell him about, only this wasn't some storybook problem where you could just plug your finger in the leak and wait for help to arrive. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. Once upon a time, what was so terrible about letting your kid play a video game while you walked 50 feet away to buy a frigging lamp? And yet Revay Walsh had been tying herself in knots ever since, thinking she was somehow responsible for what had happened. Or how about her husband John, who put the whole idea of going to Sears in her head in the first place? Hey, honey, we can save a couple of bucks if we just act now. Or how about Joe Matthews, for that matter? Maybe if he had simply cold-cocked Jack Hoffman the first time the know-it-all SOB had insulted him, the guy would have ended up in the hospital and somebody else would have taken over the case. Which, of course, wouldn't have changed anything, really, because Adam Walsh would still have been dead. The fact is that one person, and one person only, was responsible for what had happened to Adam. One person had taken that little boy and done unspeakable things to him, and Matthews was going to prove who that person was, because, quite frankly, that is the only way he knew how to give meaning to his life. On Tuesday, March 14th, Matthews met with Barry Gemelli, the former health service administrator at the Union Correctional Institution. Gemelli, himself suffering from advanced leukemia, recounted the details of the confession he heard from Toole just before he died, and confirmed that he had followed up with the criminal investigation unit at the facility both verbally and with a follow-up written report. Gemelli told Matthews that Toole seemed well aware that he was dying. He was sad and scared, and there seemed to Gemelli no reason on earth for the man to be lying. He had done something particularly terrible, and he wanted to get it off his chest. As far as Matthews was concerned, Gemelli was only underscoring what Toole had told officers when he originally confessed in 1983. "It was the youngest person I ever killed, and I feel bad about it." Even ghouls sometimes feel a pang of conscience, he thought. And then, on the following day, Wednesday, March 15th, Matthews conducted an interview that would cast new light on a matter that had seemed to color Otis Toole's confession so profoundly. Despite the fact that Toole had divulged details of the crime that only Hoffman and his fellow detectives could have known at the time, including the place where he had disposed of Adam's head, Hoffman had stuck to his accusations that Detective Buddy Terry had struck a book deal with Toole and was feeding him privileged information. However, in the course of going back through Toole's movements in Jacksonville, prior to and just after the time of the crime, Matthews had occasion to speak with John Reeves Jr., son of the owner of Reeves Roofing at the time. Yes, he'd verified all those dates pertaining to Otis Toole's work history at the company, Reeves told Matthews, and he also confirmed that his aunt, Faye McNett, had sold Toole the Cadillac, later repossessing it when Toole couldn't keep up the payments. For a time, though, Toole had used it as his work vehicle, and usually kept it full of rakes and shovels and other gardening-type tools. Toole didn't like heights, Reeves explained, so he was always doing cleanup and other such work around the job sites. Maybe he didn't like to climb because of his eyes, Reeves theorized. Toole would be looking at you, and suddenly one eye would go floating in another direction, Reeves said, accounting for the odd-looking expression that other witnesses had noted. All that was interesting enough, but it wasn't until Matthews asked the obvious question that Reeves dropped his own bombshell. Did he have any knowledge of Toole's involvement in the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh? Matthews wanted to know. Actually, he did, Reeves responded. In fact, Toole had admitted the whole thing to him in great detail during a visit they'd had in the Duval County Jail. Otis had told him he'd taken the kid from a store, though he didn't mention Sears. It was down around Miami somewhere, Reeves remembered Otis saying, and that while he was driving them back to Jacksonville, the kid wouldn't stop crying. Otis hit him hard in the stomach, and when the kid started gasping for air, Otis said he put his hands around his neck and choked him until he was dead. Then Otis said he cut his head off and threw it, or the body, into a canal. There was a lot of blood in the Cadillac as a result, Otis told him. And why was it that Reeves had not told detectives this back in 1983 when they questioned him? Matthews asked. Well, because they never asked, Reeves replied. He and Otis had their conversation about the killing a few days after the detectives had called about the dates of Toole's employment, Reeves said, and he'd just never seen the point of calling the cops back on his own. And besides, there was the matter of the book contract that he and Otis had worked out, Reeves added. Really? Matthews replied, blandly, trying to conceal his eagerness. Just what book contract was Reeves talking about? It took Reeves, who was undergoing treatment for lymph node and prostate cancer, a bit of time to find the document in his files, but finally he came up with a copy for Matthews. Dated October 29, 1983, shortly after Otis made his first confessions to detectives from four separate jurisdictions, Steve Kendrick of Brevard County, Jay Villa from Louisiana, Buddy Terry of Jacksonville, and Jack Hoffman from Hollywood, the agreement gave John Reeves Jr. the exclusive rights to any film and book adaptation of The Life and Deeds of Toole. Otis and Reeves would split any profits 50-50, the contract stipulated, and even if something happened to Toole, his surviving brothers and sisters would reap the rewards. In return for affixing his signature at the end of the document, Toole received an immediate advance against earnings of $10. So indeed there had been a book contract, Matthews realized. Reeves was just a businessman who'd recognized a good possibility when he'd seen one. Matthews would never know why Hoffman was so reluctant to pursue Otis Toole, but if it truly was his belief that Buddy Terry had struck a book deal with the killer, what a shame it was that he'd never taken the trouble to have a follow-up conversation with John Reeves, Jr. It would have dispensed with the chief ostensible reason why Hollywood PD and others in law enforcement and the media were so reluctant to believe Toole's account of the killing, and it very possibly could have changed the course of the investigation. On the following day, March 16, 2006, Matthews interviewed Sarah Patterson, the woman who called America's Most Wanted following the 1996 segment on Adam, identifying herself as Toole's niece and claiming that he had confessed the killing to her. Patterson, the last person to visit Toole in prison before his death, reiterated her account of her uncle's confession during that visit. Nothing had changed in the 10 years that had passed, she said. There was no doubt in her mind that he had done exactly what he said he did. She did not mean to be unfaithful to her uncle, who had always been good to her. But Patterson simply felt that after Otis's mother died, he lost what tenuous grip he might have had on self-control. "When Grandma Sarah died," Patterson said, "this whole family went to hell." There were some good moments, however. During his stay with her just prior to her wedding years ago, he had offered to bake a cake for the occasion, but then he'd dropped it right before the reception. Uncle Otis had spent his last $20 to buy her another, she recalled. But right was right, and the parents of that poor boy down in Hollywood deserved to know the truth. At the end of her interview with Matthews, Patterson said she wanted him to have something her uncle had given her the last day they'd talked. She handed over a sheet of paper, and Matthews found himself studying a multicolored drawing signed by Toole. "It was a clown's face," Patterson said, "and a clown's face should make you happy. But this clown's face haunted her. Looking at its dark-circled, bulging eyes and its protruding tongue reminded her of what evil her uncle did by taking the life of Adam Walsh. As much as she had once loved her Uncle Otis, she now wanted only to forget him." Jacksonville, Florida, March 17, 2006. The day after his interview with Sarah Patterson, Matthews interviewed retired Jacksonville Sheriff's Detective Jesse Buddy Terry. Terry had known Otis Toole for nearly 20 years prior to his arrest for the murder of George Sonnenberg, Terry told Matthews. A lot of cops knew Otis Toole. He had been a fringe dweller in Jacksonville from the time he was a kid. As an adult, Toole, openly gay and prone to dressing in drag, had been picked up several times for prostitution and various petty offenses, and was a suspected arsonist as well. No one, however, made him for a serial killer until James Redwine, the delinquent son of Toole's landlady, fingered Toole in the arson murder of George Sonnenberg, and Toole began to talk. Terry recounted to Matthews the details of the various interviews he had witnessed where Toole confessed to the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh, and went back over the visit he'd made to South Florida, accompanying Toole on his tour of the crime scenes. From the outset, Terry said, he was not sure why Detective Hoffman was so reluctant to view Toole's confession as truthful, for it seemed clear to every other detective who'd been involved that Toole knew things that only Adam's killer could possibly have known. As to Hoffman's accusations that he had cut a book deal with Toole, Terry was comforted to hear what Matthews had discovered about the real partners in that undertaking, but he was still indignant. He felt that he'd been used as a scapegoat in the matter, Terry said. There was so much public outcry at the lack of progress in the case that his own department was happy to let Hoffman's claims go unopposed. Though an internal affairs investigation eventually cleared Terry of Hoffman's allegations and the detective was offered his old job back, the department never issued a formal statement on the matter. To Terry, it seemed that the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office was perfectly willing to have it seem as if he had manufactured Otis Toole's various confessions out of whole cloth. Yes, practically speaking, the investigation was in the hands of Jack Hoffman and Hollywood PD. But if his own superiors had been more forceful in refuting Hoffman's trumped-up charges, more attention might have been given to Toole's statements that clearly proved his involvement in the crime. To that day, there remained no doubt in Terry's mind that Toole was responsible. He even drew us a little stick figure diagram of the area where the killing took place and how he stood over Adam with his machete to cut his head off, Terry told Matthews. Hoffman took the diagram away with him, Terry said, but as Matthews discovered, no such drawing had found its way into the case file. Somehow, he was not surprised. When he had concluded his interview with Detective Terry, Matthews once again pulled out copies of the various interviews that Jack Hoffman had conducted with Toole at the Duval County Jail. The first had taken place just before midnight on Wednesday, October 20, 1983, and during that conversation, Toole had described the Cadillac he was driving, the Sears store from which he took Adam, and the force he employed in rendering Adam unconscious. He had used a bayonet to decapitate Adam, Toole told Hoffman, and during that interview, he also claimed that Henry Lee Lucas was present during the abduction and killing, and that Lucas had sex with the decapitated head. In the course of his statement, Toole told Hoffman that he had been window shopping in the mall before he made his way to the Sears store and remembered looking at some of the wigs displayed in a nearby shop. Broward County State Attorney's investigator Phil Mundy had later ascertained that there was indeed a wig store operating in the Sears Mall at the time of Adam's abduction. It might have seemed an inconsequential detail, but Matthews knew there had been no mention of wig shops in any of the press coverage of the case. How could Toole, cross-dresser and wig fancier that he was, have known there was a wig shop in that mall unless he'd been there and seen it with his own eyes? When Hoffman and his partner Hickman left the room following that first interview, Detective Terry had confronted Toole about his contention that Henry Lee Lucas had taken part in the crime. Toole admitted lying about that and asked to speak with Hoffman and Hickman again to clarify the matter. Shortly after midnight, the Hollywood detectives took their second statement from Toole, during which he once again described using 4 or 5 blows to sever Adam's head from his body. Though in this interview, Detective Hoffman began to refer to the weapon as a machete instead of a bayonet. For a second time then, Matthews noted, Toole had confirmed detailed autopsy findings that had not been made public. And later, when Toole was trying to broker his way out of Rayford, his jailhouse lawyer, Gerald Schaefer, would tell Broward County investigators that Toole had used both a bayonet and a machete in the murder. Following those statements, on Friday, October 21st, Hoffman flew with Toole to South Florida, where Toole guided detectives to the Hollywood Sears store where Adam was taken, and then to the spot near mile marker 126 on Florida's Turnpike, where he said he had decapitated and dismembered Adam. Finally, he identified the canal at mile marker 130 as the spot where he disposed of Adam's head. At the time, Matthews noted, the only person in the party who knew Toole had ID'd the very place where fishermen had found the severed head was Jack Hoffman. It could have been the end of the matter then and there, Matthews thought, but it was not to be. On the following Wednesday, October 26th, Hoffman returned to Jacksonville to take a fourth statement from Toole, ostensibly to clarify the suspect's movements from the time he left the hospital in Newport News, Virginia, and his arrival at the Sears store in South Florida shortly thereafter. It was during that fourth statement that Toole broke down and told Hoffman, "I'm not really sure that I really did kill Adam Walsh." It occurred to Matthews that Hoffman might well have responded by asking Toole how he could have known, for instance, where Adam's head was discarded or how many blows it took to sever his head from his body, but he did not. Instead, Hoffman concluded his interview and walked out, leaving Buddy Terry to calm Toole down. Not 15 minutes later, Toole asked Hoffman to return so that he could tell the truth. Indeed, he had committed the crime, he assured Hoffman. He'd simply been upset there a few minutes ago. "I couldn't get my head together," he said. In this fifth statement, Toole went once more through a detailed account of the crime, including a graphic description of his disposal of Adam's head. After he'd driven north for 5 or 10 minutes following the dismemberment, Toole said, he pulled off the turnpike again. "I seen a little bridge down there, and I walked down there and I throwed it in the water." And what happened next, Hoffman wanted to know. He probably meant to ask what Toole did after he threw the head in the water. But Toole took Hoffman quite literally. "The head sank," he said, simply. There was a pause. "You're positive about that?" Hoffman asked. "Positive," Toole replied. And shortly thereafter, the interview was concluded. Matthews tossed the transcript down on his desk, shaking his head. That exchange might as well have been typed in red with double underlining. If a cop needed any further assurance that Toole had done just what he said he'd done, there it was on the page before him. "It sank," Matthews repeated. Yes, that's exactly what would have happened. Adam's head would have hit the water and sunk like a stone. If Toole had been making his story up, he'd have probably said something like, "It went floating off," or "It went under for a second and then it bobbed right back up." Matthews had investigated a murder case once and had known something was wrong from the moment he heard the tape of the 911 call. "Help, I think my husband's dead. He's just floating there face down in the pool." Yeah, not unless he was lying on the bottom for a couple of days first, lady. Dead bodies and body parts hit the water and go down like lead. After a couple of days and enough decomposition, gases form in cavities, and then gruesome things float to the surface. Nor were such oversights the only oddities Matthews found during his examination of Hoffman's records. Along with the failure to include Toole's drawing in the case file, and the failure to request that the Walshes come in to identify the items of clothing found during the search of Toole's mother's yard, Matthews discovered another startling inconsistency. As Matthews worked his way through the case documentation, he eventually came to a mention of the polygraph examination that he had administered to Jimmy Campbell during the early hours of August 8, 1981. Following that examination, Matthews had his first conversation with Detective Hoffman regarding his polygraph examination of Campbell. Prior to that conversation, Hoffman had not even known Campbell's name, but within moments the Hollywood detective was declaring his virtual certainty that Campbell was the perpetrator. And following the heated exchange with Detective Matthews, Hoffman tracked down and interviewed Campbell as to his alibi for the time of the kidnapping. All that was clear in Matthews's memory. However, as he studied Hoffman's files more carefully, Matthews discovered something dumbfounding. Hoffman had filed a report claiming that he had interviewed Jimmy Campbell on Friday, August 7th, the day before Matthews had alerted Hoffman to Campbell's very existence. Nor was there mention of the fact that Matthews had already conducted a polygraph examination that had cleared Campbell of any guilty knowledge concerning the crime. The report suggested that Hoffman had tracked down Jimmy Campbell on his own and then ordered Matthews to call Campbell in for a polygraph exam the following week. Furthermore, while Hoffman had assiduously recorded all other interviews he conducted in the course of his investigation, the one with Campbell was not recorded. That was for one simple reason, Matthews theorized. The date recorded on the tape would have determined when the interview actually took place. Most disturbing to Matthews, however, was a supplemental report that Hoffman filed on August 8th, where he falsely stated that the results of Matthews's polygraph examination of Campbell were inconclusive. To Matthews, all this was evidence that from the beginning, Hoffman had seen Jimmy Campbell as the perfect suspect and had set about constructing a scenario where he would seem a super sleuth for having deduced things about the case that no one else had. By switching the dates of his interview with Campbell, Hoffman had made it seem that he had smoked Campbell out, then ordered Matthews to administer a test that incriminated him. Later that evening, as Matthews made a visit to the unmarked gravesite of Toole's mother, a call came from Vanetta Cyphers, Toole's sister and the owner of the Japanese bayonet that Broward County detectives had questioned her about a decade before. Matthews had left a message for her earlier that day that he was hoping to talk with her about the matter. She was suffering from cancer, Vanetta told Matthews. In fact, she was dying. Her husband Rodney had recently died as well, and somehow the timing of Matthews's phone call, after all this time, suggested to her that it was a message from the grave, her Rodney suggesting that she tell police the truth about things she knew. She told Matthews that she and Otis were the closest of all the nine children, especially after their mother died, and that he often confided to her about some of the things he'd done. She had visited Otis in prison, a fact noted by Toole in one of his letters to John Reeves, Jr., and during that visit he told her, without expressing remorse, that he had murdered Adam Walsh. This confession had so disgusted her that she disowned her brother and refused to visit or correspond afterward. She had lied to Broward detectives when she'd told them she had that bayonet mounted above her mantle, she told Matthews. She wasn't even sure where it had come from or when she got it. It had just been stuck on a shelf somewhere. If Otis had taken the bayonet and replaced it sometime later on, she would have never known. She'd been trying to protect her brother at the time she spoke to detectives, but when she asked him point blank and he admitted the killing, she'd been sickened. She wanted Matthews to pass on what she'd told him to the Walshes. She was sorry she had not come forward sooner, but now she felt at peace. It was a score for Matthews, one more suggestion that the original investigators had been more intent on proving Otis Toole's innocence than his guilt. But he would have to keep going until he'd picked through the case file from top to bottom and, if possible, found that elusive piece of evidence that had so consumed his predecessors. On Saturday, March 18th, Matthews met with retired Brevard County Sheriff Deputy Steve Kendrick, the first police officer to whom Toole had confessed. Kendrick took Matthews back through his initial interview with Toole and the chance confusion with Broward County that had set 25 years of history into motion. "Thank God the dumb bastard couldn't spell," Kendrick said, "or else the whole thing might never have come out." When Matthews reminded him that actually the thing had not yet come out, Kendrick nodded in commiseration. Still, there was not a doubt in his mind. Toole wasn't the kind of guy who would have seen any value in confessing to such an awful thing unbidden. He'd confessed the crime to him twice, offering details that Kendrick realized, once the Hollywood police finally shared their information with him, only the killer could have known at the time. In the weeks that followed, Matthews continued to pore through the voluminous file, and in late May, he began to work back through an analysis of the physical evidence. In 1986, while still with the Miami Beach Police, Matthews had supervised the investigation of a case that stymied detectives until he ordered a tool marking analysis comparing a knife found in possession of a suspect and the wound in the deceased's chest. As a result, the killer was convicted, among the first to be solved by such means. Accordingly, on Thursday, May 25th, he coordinated a re-examination of Adam's skull for tool markings by the Miami-Dade Crime Lab and the Broward County Medical Examiner's Office. Once again, however, though the markings showed some similarities, the results were inconclusive. That same day, Matthews asked that Hollywood police turn over certain evidence that it appeared they had not yet shared with him. Matthews wanted to examine copies of the photos taken by the FDLE, specifically those of the search and analysis of Otis Toole's Cadillac. Sergeant Lyle Bean, the Hollywood officer in charge of the file, checked, but then told Matthews that there were no such photos to be found. "Well," Matthews told Bean, "FDLE reports indicated that 5 rolls of film had been shot documenting the search. If, in fact, the photos were not in Hollywood's files, perhaps Bean would be willing to call the FDLE and find out what had happened to them." Bean told Matthews he would place the call, and Matthews waited a week to follow up. On June 1st, he called back. "They haven't found them yet, but they're still looking," Bean said. On June 19th, Matthews placed yet another call to Bean, asking for an update on the status of those misplaced photographs. The FDLE had told him that no such photos existed in their files, Bean said. Matthews hung up and sat pondering the situation for a moment. 23 years had passed. Witnesses had died, the likely killer of Adam Walsh had died, and a great deal of evidence had disappeared as well. If the bloody carpet samples had vanished, along with the 4,200-pound automobile from which they'd come, why couldn't 5 rolls worth of photographs have vaporized as well? Still, Matthews was not the sort to leave stones unturned. If you were a good cop, you turned them all over. And sometimes, if you were lucky, you found exactly what you were looking for. He reached for the phone then and called the FDLE crime lab himself. He'd have to speak to someone in the photo lab, a voice told him, and Matthews waited patiently while he was transferred. When an attendant answered, he explained that he was simply following up on the request of Sergeant Bean from Hollywood PD. Were they absolutely certain that no copies of the photographs taken of Otis Toole's Cadillac back in 1983 existed in their files? There was a pause on the other end. No one in the office seemed to know what Matthews was talking about. There'd been no request for any photos from anyone at Hollywood PD. Matthews nodded and hung up. He'd played this game before. Except the last time around, the joker on the other side of the table had been a guy named Jack Hoffman. In the end, Matthews spoke to an FDLE public information officer, Sharon Gogarty, who checked the files in reference to Hollywood PD case number 81-56073. Yes, she told Matthews, they had 98 photo negatives pertaining to the processing of suspect Otis Toole's vehicle. Well then, Matthews asked, would it be possible for him to obtain copies of the prints? Gogarty paused, then said a surprising thing. There were no prints, she told Matthews. The film had been processed into negatives for the purposes of storage, standard operating procedure at FDLE, but never in 23 years had any prints been developed. Matthews paused. In other words, he asked, no detective has ever requested or looked at the photos taken of Otis Toole's Cadillac? That would seem to be the case, Gogarty replied brightly, but you can be the first. On Tuesday, June 27, 2006, an FDLE regional legal advisor, John Kenner, sent 98 photographs copied from lab case file 831043357 to Matthews at America's Most Wanted, where staffers in turn forwarded them to his offices in Davie, a few miles northwest of Hollywood. Matthews, who had come in early that Wednesday to work on his report, glanced up as his longtime secretary, Mary Alvarez, came through his door with a hefty UPS envelope in hand. "Were you expecting something in the overnight?" she asked. "Indeed he was," Matthews assured her. He set his coffee aside and quickly spread out the thick sheaf of 3x5-inch prints on his desk, trying all the while to keep his expectations under control. He was excited to have unearthed the photographs, but he had suffered his share of setbacks on this case before. In all honesty, it wouldn't have surprised him to find he'd been sent a series of shots of an FDLE employee's birthday party. This time, though, he'd hit pay dirt. He was looking at the outset for any shots of the rear bumper of the Cadillac, when he quickly found three that depicted the sizable dent described by both William Mistler and Bobby Lee Jones, Toole's co-worker from Jacksonville. Matthews nodded with satisfaction. It was confirmation that indeed it was Toole's car that Mistler had seen in the Sears parking lot the day that Adam had been taken. "Good, good, good," is Matthews's characteristic way of expressing enthusiasm, and that is what he murmured as he turned to see what other treasures might have come his way. There were other shots of the Cadillac's exterior, dashboard, and seats, but he expected nothing of real import there. Of far more interest were a series of dark shots that resembled negatives, dotted here and there by objects that glowed a psychedelic blue. In fact, these were a set of specially processed shots taken by FDLE crime scene investigators using luminol technology to identify or enhance the presence of blood traces on items of evidence. In this process, ordinary photographs are taken of objects, then chemicals that become luminescent when in contact with blood are applied to those objects, and the photographs taken again. The second series of photos are shot in darkness, with a wide aperture setting and the lens open for a minute or more. The only images that appear are special luminescent markers that orient the viewer, and any part of the item where blood residue, invisible to the naked eye, might exist. Anything that retains the presence of blood will show up in a ghostly metallic blue. Matthews first went about arranging a comparison of a set of photos taken of the front driver's side floorboards. Given all the disappointments of the past quarter century, he expected little. But now, he sat staring in disbelief at what was laid out before him. The pictures of the front floorboard carpeting, shot in ordinary light, showed nothing beyond the ordinary dirt and dings he might expect, except for the presence of the orienting marker the technician had placed along the edge of the carpet. But as Matthews placed the corresponding luminol-enhanced shot alongside the first, he could hear Otis Toole's reply to Jack Hoffman during his confession of October 20th, 1983, ringing in his mind. Hoffman, did you get blood all over you from the child? Toole, I got it on my shoes. I throwed my shoes away, too, and I put another pair of shoes on. So you did, Matthews murmured to himself. So you damned well did. There in the photograph before him glowed a blood-engendered image of a pair of shoe prints firmly planted on the driver's floorboards. Matthews set those images aside, well aware of the significance of the discovery. At long last, here was physical evidence tying Otis Toole to the crime. He set aside the images of the bloody footprints and turned to another set of prints of the machete that Detective Terry had confiscated from Toole's car dealer associate in Jacksonville. In one of his confessions, Toole had mentioned wrapping tape around the handle of his machete to keep from getting blisters, and the luminol shot of the machete with its taped-up handle showed nothing. But in a second image, taken after the tape had been removed from its handle, the wooden grips of the blade glowed from blood as if radioactive.